Before we get to today's show, I want to mention that this episode is brought to you by our partners at EduTech. EduTech is Australia's largest educational festival and returns to Melbourne on the 24th and 25th of August. With over 450 inspiring speakers, captivating keynotes, engaging workshops, enlightening panels, immersive breakout sessions, and 400 market leaders on the expo floor, this is an experience you won't want to miss. And yes, Ed Leaders will be there, so you can come by and say g'day to us too. Register now with code EDLEADERS30 for an extra 30% off your ticket. Visit edutech.net.au for more details. All right, welcome to Ed Leaders, the podcast covering all the interesting ideas about leadership, strategy, culture, and the business of K-12 education, and where we believe with better leaders, we'll make better schools. I'm your host, Luke Kelly, and joining me each week in the chair is my co-host and ex-colleague, Matthew Irving. Before we get started, if you haven't already, you should sign up to the weekly email sent out every few weeks by the team at Ed Leaders. Matthew, what should someone expect if they sign up for the newsletter?
Well, I'm a little bit put off by the ex-colleague piece, but anyway, I'm moving on and getting some therapy. Look, in terms of the newsletter, I think from time to time, there's a really great synergy between our guests on the podcast and what's in the newsletter. And certainly our subject today, as we dive into AI, there's some wonderful things in the newsletter about AI and what's in the marketplace. So there's a really nice synergy between the content. So I suggest you go and read it.
All right, Matt, give you 8.5 out of 10 for that. Well played. You can sign up to the newsletter at edleaders.com.au. Now on to today's guest, Leon Furze. From high school teacher, English teacher, director of teaching and learning, he's taken the leap out of schools to educational writing and consulting. He is the author of Practical Reading Strategies and Practical Writing Strategies, and he's currently studying a PhD on the impact of generative AI in education and writing instruction. Talk about a timely and important PhD. Leon is also a keynote speaker at this year's EduTech Festival in Melbourne, and today's episode is part of a 5-part series with EduTech, going behind the scenes to give the audience a little bit more background about the headline acts. So without further ado, let's get to it. Leon, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Luke and Matt. It's good to be here.
Excellent. Well, we love to share, to start the show with you sharing a little bit about, you know, your professional journey, your professional experiences and your journey into education.
Yeah, look, I grew up in Stoke-on-Trent in England, which is fairly low socioeconomic part of the UK. And my own schooling was a little bit bumpy. I started off as a computing maths and physics kind of kid and then ended up doing an English literature degree at university, if that's any indication of what school was like. Pinged out the other side of the English lit degree, thinking, what am I going to do with an English lit degree? And kind of fell into teaching. I did my teaching rounds in the UK, worked in a few pretty hair-raising schools, taught down in London for a little while, and then moved over here with my wife, who's Australian, and we met traveling. So came back to the farm, Southwest Victoria, and never left.
Very nice.
And Leon, can you just describe some of the maybe the experiences that you've had as you've sort of transitioned from, you know, working in schools in the UK and then sort of working in schools in Australia?
Yeah, look, the schools that I worked in the UK were all quite large. You know, we had classes of 30 plus kids. The school I worked at in London was an all boys school in Northeast London. And I'm sure a few of your listeners might be familiar with that. There's a lot of Australians teaching in that neck of the woods. Moved in at the end of 2009 to Southwest Victoria and worked then for the next 12 years, really, in a lovely small Catholic school out here in Hamilton. And just had a great time. So that transition was a bit of a culture shock initially. And then through that 12-year period working at the college here in Hamilton, just great experience, a lot of different leadership roles. I've worn many different hats and I've had a lot of opportunities to explore working with different organizations. So, I mean, for me, really, the point that led me to this transition out and this PhD and this part of my journey has probably mostly been my work as an English teacher and an English leader, writing those books that you mentioned at the top, Luke, and just working with the English teacher community in Victoria.
And when you think about those, you know, the books that you've written and your move out of the classroom space and out of the school space, has there been, you know, any, I guess, formative experiences there that kind of made you kind of or helped you along that with that choice? And I guess more broadly with your writing and your books, what kind of impact are you trying to have with the books?
Yeah, when I took over as a head of English in 2017, we joined the Victorian Association for the Teaching of English, VATE. They ran a community of practice looking into reading. So it was a research project. Our school joined it. And then I actually later joined VATE's council, left for a few years and just joined again in May this year. So that association with the English Teachers Council has been really formative along the way. The community of practice that our school took part in for 3 years was really what led to the first book that I wrote, the Practical Reading Strategies book. And that just went gangbusters. You know, that was really popular, still is really popular with English teachers across the country. I think I sold one in Scotland somehow, but across Australia it's been really popular. So I've been really pleased with the outcome there.
And so as you start to describe, you know, that those notions of community of practice and then, you know, writing and I guess engaging with the profession, is there a sense that, you know, your vocation has sort of really shifted from students to that kind of the professional context?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as many people listening would know, the higher up you move through school leadership, the less contact time you get with students anyway. So by the time I finished my school role, I was director of learning and teaching. And I really only had a couple of classes, a handful of students. You know, I had a year 12 English class. I had a year 9 elective where we were playing around with some design thinking and some entrepreneurial work. But other than that, my time was taken up with meetings and admin and working with the staff. So I've actually probably been working with teachers rather than students for a long time. And then as I finished up and stepped out into the PhD study, I do quite a bit of sessional academic work now, so working with pre-service teachers. And I actually just really enjoy working with teachers and working with adults in this state and across other places.
And Leon, you also work with adults in different contexts as well. I know that you're a director of a number of different organisations, including Young Change Agents, but also Reframing Autism. Is there a connection there professionally?
Yeah, the board director roles are really interesting, you know. So they're both national not-for-profits. And as I said, I recently rejoined the English Association Board Council as well. And I just find those jobs fill a bit of an interesting niche that you don't really get through the professional side of teaching otherwise. So I joined YCA Young Change Agents back when I was still working at the school as their kind of educator on the board. Great organization to work with. They run entrepreneurial education programs up and down the country, and then joined Reframing Autism a little bit later than that. We went through our own kind of autistic diagnosis journey as as parents, individuals, and me also reflecting professionally. And Reframing Autism, actually, I completed one of their courses, a 6-month-long professional certificate in autistic education, and joined their board at some point along that journey because I was so impressed with the work that they were doing.
And to the now, you're going back and doing a PhD. Talk to us about that decision and, you know, what it means to you professionally to want to go back and start a PhD and what that means that you're hoping to get from undertaking that.
Yeah, madness, I think. The journey came, I reckon, earlier in the year in 2022. So I actually handed in my resignation in term 2, although I saw out the role until the end of 2022. And after I handed in my notice, I knew that I wanted to do something else, wasn't quite sure what. And then the opportunity for the PhD scholarship came up. So I was never really... I hadn't set my sights on jumping out of the classroom and into the PhD, but the opportunity arose, and my supervisor, Lucinda, and I had a connection through VATE, through the English Teachers Council, that went back a few years. And she said, look, there's an opportunity here to work with digital writing, digital texts. And I'd already been interested in generative AI, particularly. This was all pre-ChatGPT. So there weren't that many of us interested at the time. So I jumped on the opportunity to do the scholarship.
So, Leon, you know, as you sort of started to describe your profile, you know, is this a sense of, you know, another one of those great overachievers that make us look really poor here on Ed Leaders? But jokes aside, you know, as you bring all those threads professionally together, including the PhD, can you boil it down into your why, you know, in terms of, you know, what gives you life and the thing, I guess the frame in which you're pursuing all these things?
I love learning and creativity. And I think those two things go hand in hand really well with the kind of work that I've always done, but particularly the kind of work that I do now. So, you know, I do a lot of writing, I do a lot of blogs, I do a lot of, you know, making courses, online work, working in schools face-to-face, all of that kind of work there's a lot of creativity involved with it. And I always feel like I'm learning new things. So, you know, just recently I've been last week with a couple of my client schools in Melbourne as part of my consulting work, and running parent breakfasts and listening to students and getting feedback from teachers about AI. All of that kind of work I find really, really kind of keeps me interested and keeps me excited.
I'm always interested in when someone's writing a blog, whether they're writing it for themselves or whether they're writing it for the audience.
It's always a bit of both.
Where do you land on that?
80-20? No. Look, my blog started out again for VCE English teachers, really specifically. And, you know, I had probably about 4 subscribers for maybe 6 months. I'm pretty certain that one of them was my dad, with a pseudonym. And over time, I wrote a lot about, you know, my work as a VCE assessor and my opinion as a former English leader and my work through VATE Council. And then the book kind of unfolded and the blog started to support the book. And then towards, I don't know, about September last year, I started dipping my toes into writing about AI. And I kind of felt my audience shift a little bit. So I still do quite a lot of writing about the VCE English curriculum specifically, but then the much broader part of my audience now is interested, hopefully interested, in the AI stuff. And yeah, the blog's really taken off, obviously, alongside all of this artificial intelligence work.
Hmm. So, Leon, that's probably a really great point to pivot the conversation and segue into AI, which is something we want to sort of delve into today. So, you know, wondering if you could describe to us, you know, this sort of notion of the AI iceberg, if you like. How would you best describe that to kick off the conversation today?
I love an analogy. As an English teacher and as a teacher broadly, I think you can't get away with not using analogies, can you? It's either like a multicolored pyramid or a Venn diagram, or this one I've gone with the iceberg. And it was interesting when I made a post about this AI iceberg idea, I saw that David DiCavallo from Acara also called AI an iceberg in a slightly different context. So it's obviously a good analogy. When I talk about it with teachers, a lot of the professional development I do with people with very little understanding or knowledge around the technical side of things. And I think it's important to get across some of the technical parts of the systems. So I like to talk about the iceberg having this huge below the waterline data set powering these kinds of artificial intelligence models. First of all, I think the data set is really important to start getting your head around. And then the fact that the bit that we interact with above the waterline, I guess, the part of the iceberg that we can see, the language model, has in some cases further refinements at the top of it, like ChatGPT and other applications built on top. But really the most important part about that iceberg analogy is that that huge data set sits under the waterline. We don't know what's there. We don't know what's in it exactly. But we know that like an iceberg, in fact, that under the water part is potentially dangerous and definitely gives the iceberg most of its structure and its importance.
I think that's one of the biggest challenges with the AI data set is that we don't really understand how big it is, where it's been gathered from and how it's been gathered.
Back when OpenAI was still open, they published research papers saying exactly what was in their data sets. So we've seen sort of information and research papers on what was in GPT-2, for example. By the time we get to GPT-3.5 and Microsoft's investing billions, that information starts to get locked away. GPT-4 you know, there's no further information on how that was trained. And then we have models like Google's Palm language model. No idea what's in there, really, beyond a few of the basics, which seem to be in all of these models. So this idea of proprietary data going into the data sets is something that's really important. In an educational context, we know that there's going to be a lot of organizations building their own models in similar ways. So we can take a safe bet that the major publishers have got a lot of proprietary data and they'll build that into their own data sets. We know that Khan Academy have done that for their chatbot, Duolingo for theirs. So there's a real sort of interesting conversation to be had in education about what we're going to use these technologies for if we don't know exactly what's driving them.
And Leo, because of that notion of not really understanding what's sitting underneath the, at the bottom of the iceberg, if you like, particularly around data sets, is it your experience and particularly sort of working with schools and looking at the commentary, that because of that fear, there's been a real sort of reactionary approach by many in schools where either, fully embracing it or we're canning it, we're banning it. It's all too hard because there's too many unknowns.
Definitely the unknowns. I'm not sure about a kind of a reaction or a fear around these things. I think based on my experience as a teacher, term one just flies by, and these technologies landed really during the holidays for us in Australia. So we might have seen a bit of media hype, but we didn't really see it in the classroom right away. Term one hits, you've got swimming sports, athletics, probably an awards ceremony or two, a parent-teacher interviews night, and then it's gone. And then term two rolls around and everybody's still talking about this AI thing. And what I've noticed is that schools are now starting to come around to the idea of policy and staff professional development. So I've certainly engaged with a lot more schools in term two than in term one. And I think that people are starting to get their heads around the idea that these are ethically complex technologies, but that they're not going away. So we have to kind of deal with them.
And when you describe they're ethically complex, can you describe a little bit more around, what are some of the ethical issues that you see?
Yeah. So I've just finished a series of posts, which was, it started off as one post. And then I ended up writing 9 more about the ethical concerns, which kind of goes to show how many ethical concerns there are. Cause I had to limit it to 9. The biggest one I talk about when I'm talking to teachers, though, is the bias and discrimination issue, which I think is pretty prevalent in the media. And essentially, a lot of that comes from that huge data set. So if we think that the data set that powers a language model is mostly trained on English language text, and the majority of the English language text in the data set is written by white Western males, gives it an inherent bias. That's not to say that there's anything inherently wrong with white Western males, particularly in this room here with 3 of us. But it does mean that the AI has that worldview, and that when you're interacting with something built on that, with that data set, you're essentially interacting with something which has the majority of that perspective. So that can cause hidden biases, it can cause unseen biases. And then on top of that, we also know that there is deliberately toxic or hateful content in the data set. So stuff that goes out on places like Twitter or Reddit or other social media sites or right-wing blogs and places like that, which contain deliberately discriminatory language, ableist, sexist, misogynist, racist, and all of those kinds of discrimination. So there's really 2 problems. One is the baked-in worldview of the English language part of the data set and the perspective that text comes from. And the other is the deliberately toxic material that has to be manually filtered out. So it's a really complex issue. For me, it's the biggest ethical issue that concerns us in education, because we are working with such a diverse range of students, and we wouldn't want to use a technology that's going to further marginalize some of our already at-risk students.
And Leon, that kind of, I guess, marries up the type of conversations we were having straight after the holidays with my leadership team around that worldview and that notion of a Western-centric, white view of the world. And we talked about bias and we talked about potential sort of toxic, commentary and the like that would come from the technology. And so, that's really live, I think, for teachers. And as you've described, it's really quite live for schools. How would you best advise school leaders to, I guess, start that conversation, but also frame it in such a way that we're moving towards, I guess, you know, some maybe some guidelines or some tips to I guess, frame the types of things that are going to happen in classrooms?
One of the schools that I work with, we ran a student forum, and a student actually offered a really nice analogy here. We were talking about the ethical complexities, and we had a bit of a debate over whether we should even use these technologies at all. And this student put her hand up and said, you know, who here arrived to school this morning in a car? You know, most of the room put their hands up. And she said, well, you know, cars are ethically massively complex. You know, we've got the fuel industry, we've got the manufacturing of cars, we've got the whole kind of supply chain of automobile industry, which is ethically complex. But it doesn't stop us from driving cars. We just have rules and laws. And we also have personal understanding of how to drive a car safely and ethically. And I think that's what it's going to come down to. You know, we will eventually have rules and laws and regulations. I know that they're working on a national education generative AI policy. Until then, schools need to understand that we're going to be engaging with these technologies in many different ways on a daily basis, much like driving to work. And we need to learn to navigate these as ethically as we can ourselves. We can't rely on regulation and policy.
I guess just to ask it in a different way, do you think that the bias has changed? Like if you think back to, you know, our era of Encyclopedia Britannica or World Book, and the percentage of potentially those articles that were written by the same people that, you know, are quoted in ChatGPT or in the language model, you know, or, you know, prior to the last 40 or 50 years, as more women have been in the workplace, you know, the way history was written. Do you think that the bias has changed for ChatGPT, or is it just more prominent in the way it delivers information or the amount of information it can deliver?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting conversation, and it's sort of out of my wheelhouse, academically speaking, but there's some really great researchers through my university at Deakin University looking at decolonizing data. And just this idea that we know that this huge volume of data does have this inherent bias. Now, the bias in the kind of media that we're producing as a society at the moment might be slightly less biased than it was historically, but it's also at a much more massive scale. So we can't get away from the problem. It's a really sort of double-edged sword. Whilst we may have seen advances in society in terms of, let's say, gender equality, if we compare it to the 1950s, for example, if we compare the amount of media production and content production that's going online now to the 1950s, it's not even in the same ballpark. So what we have to contend with is not just the bias, but it's the scale and the speed with which that can then disseminate, which obviously with generative AI combined with social media is, I don't think we even know what that looks like yet. That's huge.
Hmm. And as we continue to sort of, I guess, unpack, you know, concerns, obviously privacy is certainly one, and who owns the data, and, you know, how is information being collected, particularly around prompts and the like. What's your view on that? Sort of talk to the listeners about some of the privacy concerns.
Yeah, ChatGPT only maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago released a function where you can basically put it into incognito mode, and you can turn your data off from being used in future training. Prior to that, they were training all models on all the prompts and data that was being entered. And I think, you know, one thing that's really evident is we see big companies like Apple and Samsung various other firms banning their employees from using it because they're too worried about their proprietary information ending up in the model, then we know that there's going to be a privacy concern. I read an article just this morning about another huge data leak from ChatGPT into the dark web, so releasing people's prompt histories and personal account details up to the highest bidder. I think that there is a privacy concern, but also that it's in the same kind of area as the privacy concerns that we're familiar with in education around not putting students' identifying information or personal information into systems online, around our own kind of digital hygiene, I guess, and making sure that we're using our computers properly and not opening ourselves up for malware and all of those things. So, you know, in one sense, it's business as usual in terms of data privacy and security. We just need to be even more conscious of best practice.
Do you think that we'll know when, a product such as ChatGPT is being used through an API or through other systems, and that the information that we're using in one product is then being transferred into secondary and third products, and that we'll clearly be aware of where that data is ending up?
I think that entirely depends on how much attention you pay to the terms and conditions when you sign things. This might be a rhetorical question. Look, you don't have to answer this one, but when a terms and conditions pops up, or an update to a terms and conditions, do you just scroll right down to the bottom and tick that box and move on with your life like most of us? Or are you going to linger and read that in detail? Because I think legally the terms and conditions would have to tell us where that data is going, but pragmatically and realistically, nobody reads it. Mm. And that's how they've gotten away with it for so long, these companies who are hoarding all of our data. So I don't think that's going to change, unfortunately.
If you love what we do here at EdLeaders, then please support us by supporting our sponsors. And as you heard at the top of the show, today's sponsor is Edutech. Edutech is one giant festival for all of education, and this year is happening on the 24th and 25th of August at the Melbourne Convention Exhibition Centre. Not only will you hear from an amazing lineup of speakers, including today's guest, you'll also be able to meet us there. Yes, that's right. EdLeaders is coming to Melbourne, and you'll be able to stop by and say g'day in the exhibition hall, featuring over 450 exhibitors, where you can see some of the latest and greatest from the world of technology and innovation. Aside from seeing us there, you can learn from some of the best educators around the globe with learning streams for school leaders, teachers, ICT managers, and digital technology, just to name a few. There are also boundless opportunities to hang out, network, make new connections, and exchange ideas. If there is one conference this year to level up your leadership game, this is it. Register now with code EDLEADERS30, that's EDLEADERS30, for 30% off your ticket. Visit edutech.net.au for details. And make sure you support us by stopping by and saying hello. Now let's get back to today's show.
So Leon, let's kind of change this up. We've been talking about, some of the concerns and the complexities around AI. Let's talk about the opportunities, for learning and teaching, and some of the things that you're seeing where teachers in the classroom are using AI for impact.
I think that the most interesting applications I've seen have come from the fact that schools have engaged their teachers really rapidly. So I want to start there. You know, having said that schools have had a bit of a bumpy start to ChatGPT, we have to remember this technology dropped in November, and we're now in June, and these conversations are happening across the country. So one thing I've seen that is really positive is just the level of involvement that's come from educators and people willing to get their hands dirty and learn how to use these technologies. And then in the classroom, I've seen some fantastic ideas coming through for personalizing and differentiating and modifying work. So I think as long as people are mindful of that kind of inherent bias and those issues that we mentioned earlier, these are some really powerful potential applications of things like ChatGPT. You know, if you've got a student sitting in front of you and they're not engaging with the work in some way, then they can take the work themselves, or you can kind of workshop the prompt with them that can very quickly adjust the materials, make it more engaging, make it more personalized, make it keyed into something they're particularly interested in. Any of those kinds of things that ordinarily would take us a long time to do. I ran a session earlier today for some teachers, and we spoke about differentiation and modifying work for students' needs. We said we know that we have to do it and we really want to do it, but we've got 20-something kids sitting in front of us for 50 minutes, and then they rotate 6 times a day. So I think the big gain from this kind of technology is going to help us to solve some of those problems.
When you think about it from an academic lens, and I'm seeing this a bit more online in recent times, when people are using ChatGPT as a source, they're being required to cite it in one way or another. Do you think as we evolve and as teachers kind of start using it more, schools start using it more, do you think we will see a shift to staff acknowledging when they've used it as well as the students being required to cite it? I mean, what are your thoughts there on how much we need to be citing its use in a day-to-day world of a staff member? Because I sometimes think that sometimes as a staff member we're expecting a kid to cite it for an assignment, but then we're not citing it when we set out, you know, whether it be a newsletter or a class for the day. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, obviously in the tertiary context, they got onto academic integrity and citation really quickly because they had to. And some universities went down the track of you've got to include it in your citations, you've got to do an author date kind of citation whenever you've used it and whatever. And then other institutions just said, look, mention it in your introduction and maybe include a prompt or two in your appendix as an example. I prefer the latter. But realistically, you know, Copilot's going to drop into Microsoft Windows very soon. Duet will be all across Google's systems. Are we going to be citing every time we use a chatbot function to generate a PowerPoint or to knock together a Word document? I don't think we will. We don't currently cite when we use Grammarly and we don't cite when we use Microsoft Word instead of writing a note on a piece of paper with a pen. So I think realistically, the citation thing will go away. What I think will need to happen is in an academic context and secondary as well as tertiary, people will need to acknowledge when they've used generative AI to create content for academic purposes, but not when they're just doing sort of day-to-day interactions with the technology.
It's a really interesting point. You know, as you would know, Leon, being in schools, it's report writing time. And, you know, we've had a number of staff that have actually used ChatGPT to write reports, comments. You know, they've put in a whole lot of prompts, you know, maybe a frame, strengths of the student, you know, just dot points, et cetera. It's framed up a beautiful response. They then have obviously had to personalize it because obviously the notion of a report is, you know, the kid's known, they're cared for, and there's some direction about learning going forward. And they've used it to great effect. But the concern is if I'm a parent, I copy and paste that, ChatGPT, did you create that? You know, how are our consumers or our clients going to feel if we're using that? And it's just a really, I guess, pointy example of, I guess, what we're talking about.
Yeah, I've got, I guess sometimes it's a bit of an unpopular opinion, especially because I'm not actually in the classroom anymore. So people can go, well, you can say what you want. You're not actually doing it. But I feel like there are certain things that we shouldn't be using the AI for. Now, I'm not saying that we should necessarily be writing lengthy report comments, but if we are, I don't think we should be using AI for them. Not because it's sort of, you know, cheating, I guess is the word, but because I'm really concerned about this idea of AI de-skilling teachers. You know, I think there's some things that teachers should be doing, and I think that giving genuine feedback and building those relationships with students is exactly what we should continue to do. The problem I have with report writing is if I take that process and I make it more efficient by using AI and then a parent gets that report, I can imagine this kind of world where the parent opens up that report while they're driving to work or something and their AI assistant reads it back to them in summary form. Nobody's really paying attention to anything that's going in either direction. And all we've done is we've taken a redundant process and made it slightly more efficient. So are there ways that we can use the technology to kind of trim the fat elsewhere, free up a bit more time so we can actually just have a conversation with that parent or to give the feedback to the child verbally rather than writing it down and expecting them to go away and read it? Because I think, you know, 9 times out of 10, nobody's writing those those lengthy bits of feedback, whether it's feedback that goes to the students or even sometimes feedback that goes to the parents. So look, let's not use the technology just to make dull things more efficient. Let's use them to kind of carve out the other parts and free up a bit of time for the really good bits.
Yeah, I was going to actually kind of go a little bit further on that notion of de-skilling, and I think that's really interesting in terms of it feels as though probably for one of the maybe not the definitely not the first time in history, but one of the quickest times in history for education. We were both trying to upskill ourselves, and we still are trying to upskill ourselves in the use of generative AI, but at the same time trying to then teach our students how to use generative AI and the complexities and the ethical concerns that they should be considering around it when we're still trying to grapple that with that ourselves as adults. And I wonder around, it's very interesting to hear you talk about then the de-skilling of staff in certain other areas if we are upskilling too much in the area of use of AI.
Yeah, I think we have to find balance. You know, there's a lot of talk at the moment about needing to put AI into the curriculum and every child needs to learn how to do AI and all of this kind of conversation. Some of that's getting swept along with the hype. I mean, we've had those conversations about digital technologies since day one, really. A lot of the research that I'm doing now, you can read things from the 1990s that look as if they were written yesterday in terms of talking about how policy and curriculum in particular needs to be updated to allow for digital technologies and cyberspace. What I would like to see happen is a more kind of holistic approach to bringing in AI. So, you know, I'm going to go into bat for the humanities and the arts and talk about how important that lens and that understanding is for understanding some of the ethical concerns. We don't all need to become AI teachers. You know, we don't all need to suddenly become experts in artificial intelligence. We just need to be cognizant of the technology and its strengths and its limitations and how that works in the context of our subject discipline and our expertise.
And I think more broadly that we're just going to have to be more mindful of that in every interaction that we have. You know, the same way that, you know, a young student uses email almost ubiquitously because it's a service that they've always had. You know, when, you know, you're talking about Copilot coming into Microsoft, it's just going to be a service that they've always had access to. So it's interpreting that as a young person growing up, that's just going to be a part of the norm of what they do, I think.
Mm. Yeah. There's a Vincent Mosco who wrote a book called The Digital Sublime. It's a great read. It's a bit heavy going and it's about cyberspace and the internet, but he talks about technologies just essentially disappearing once they become ubiquitous enough. And actually he's talking about electricity, literally receding into the woodwork as the wiring for electrical things moved into people's walls. And we don't think about electricity, do we? Just in the same way that we don't think about whipping out your phone and searching for something on Google, even though that's really a technology that's only been around for, 15 years. So these technologies will become ubiquitous. That doesn't mean we should stop being critical and mindful of how we're using them. In fact, I think that's more of an imperative for having that critical lens.
I think part of the challenge also is that mindset or teacher identity needs to shift. You know, we just talked about that idea that teachers don't have to be experts in this, but how do they adopt an identity of one of curiosity, of facilitation, of advising students and mentoring students, rather than feeling like they actually have to be at the front and center of this emerging technology and then they need to be an expert. You know, I wonder how we, shape those identities and let teachers know it's okay.
I love a bit of community work with teachers. That's why I'm on all of those sort of boards and councils and things. I think that it's really important that everybody gets brought along together in these kinds of endeavors. So I think sometimes our education system doesn't really help because we will see schools being competitive over who can incorporate the most AI or who has the best AI leaders, and I'm sure that schools will start to create director of artificial intelligence positions to outsell their local competition.
I saw one on the weekend in the UK. Yep.
So, I think the education system just is going to shoot itself in the foot in some instances in that kind of competitive, high stakes environment that we create for ourselves. I think ultimately what would be much more healthy is if as a community, we can just get everybody on board for the journey.
Yeah, sometimes we struggle with that, Leon, in schools.
Particularly in Australia. Yeah. I thought the UK was dog eat dog, but Australia is something else.
I want to go back to something you mentioned just a little bit earlier, which is You mentioned that you'd started looking at AI, earlier last year, probably before the rush of ChatGPT. And I know from the podcast I listened to, there was a lot of talk about it in the US in terms of some early, what people were seeing, and they were being blown away with it. But it wasn't really, for most people until there was a free version available with ChatGPT that they actually saw it for the first time. I'm interested in kind of what you were experiencing last year before the ChatGPT wave hit, and what you were surfacing before then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started writing blog posts about it back in June, I think. But I'd seen at the coalface, in my year 12 English classroom, students using spinners, we were calling them back then, back 1 year ago. the kind of paraphrasing tools, which were actually built on top of GPT-2, just not really advertised as such. And so we saw tools like Smodin was one, Write Sonic. A lot of different at Jasper that were used in a similar way, but in a much more limited capacity. So students were using them to paraphrase notes, or they were copying in big chunks of essays and then getting them to spin them up into new essays. They stuck out like a sore thumb, particularly with the kinds of students that were using them, who were normally the ones who were trying to dodge out of writing an essay because it would be the first time they've ever written an essay in their life. But I'd seen that in the classroom as a year 12 teacher. And Lucinda McKnight, my PhD supervisor, had written an article in The Conversation in 2021 flagging these technologies and talking about, education's going to have to deal with this sooner or later. And nobody was listening in 2021, but that's definitely become one of her most well-read articles, I think. It's definitely on everybody's agenda now.
And the transition there to the PhD and the work that you're doing with her now, can you tell us a little bit more about what you're hoping to achieve with the PhD and where you're going with it?
Well, I'm still pre-confirmation at the moment, so I've got to get that.
Minor detail.
it's keeping within my areas of interest, really. So I'm looking at generative artificial intelligence, broader than just text. I'm looking across, image generation and a few other technologies. And I'm looking at the implications for teachers, for writers, for people who create texts. In the sense of what is this going to do for the identity of people like me and the other educators that I work with.
And Leon, we're heading towards August, EduTech. You're going to be presenting there. What can the audience expect?
Well,
or are you still working on that?
Let me figure out what my sessions are first. Now, I've got a couple of sessions on the books for EduTech this year, which is exciting because last year I just had a very short session. So in terms of the AI content, though, it'll be related to this kind of conversation. I'll be talking about how schools can work with these technologies appropriately, ethically, proactively, and creatively. I think it's really important to balance that idea of being critical and creative. So hopefully that's what they'll take away from the AI session.
And one of the things we love to do at Ed Leaders is always get the crystal ball out and kind of think about the future and what that might look like. I guess in today's context, I'm really interested in your thoughts on, you couldn't really imagine that the contextual change of AI in the last 6 months. But if we were now looking ahead 6 years, what do you think it looks like?
I think that conversation we had about platforms, it was really important. So the way that these technologies will be integrated seamlessly into the platforms we already use. And I am very confident that we'll move in the direction of speech prompting, speech to text or speech recognition. So I think in 6 years' time, we'll be interacting verbally with systems that have the next generation of GPT-style models built into them in our operating system, in our phone, in our cars, in all of those systems that we already have digital technologies built in.
I like to think that I'm just going to be able to send you an email, Leon, and AI will take care of the rest of the podcast. It'll know my voice. It'll know what, you know, kind of questions Matt likes to ask and where and what you're going to respond with. And it will just make the podcast for us without us even talking.
Hey, look, I've already made a deep fake of my own voice, which was convincing enough to fool my wife, who's known me for a little while. So this is definitely not 6 years away. Look, I think we can outsource your job in probably 2 or 3 months. Don't worry about it.
Uh-oh. Matt, why are you cheering?
No reason. No reason.
He gets his Wednesday nights back.
Yeah. We're going to be so slick. Like the quality of what we're producing will just be next level.
Well, they are next level, Matt. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, it'll cut out all the ums and the ahs and the, you know, the awkward sort of, you know, pauses.
The human bits.
The human bits.
I'm going a step further with that, Leon. The future of school. We always like to ask this question when we take a, you know, 10-year horizon. What does the future of school look like? More broadly, just beyond AI, but where do you see the future of schooling going?
I'm going to end on an optimistic note because sometimes people accuse me of being a little bit critical or a little bit too hard on the ethical doom and gloom. Optimistically, I hope that these technologies will free up our time more than anything else so that we can interact with students as people rather than just as bums on seats in a classroom or a lecture hall. And, you know, that's K-12 through to tertiary. For secondary schools, I think that this has real opportunities to allow us to, you know, continue to build those really strong relationships with students. So that's my optimistic endpoint.
And before we get to my favorite segment, which is the 6 in 60 seconds, it's Matt's least favorite segment, but that's okay. Is there anything, any other last words of wisdom, you know, for principals out there, for the audience out there? Or, you know, a question you'd like to throw over to us before we get to my favorite segment?
I guess a lot of your listeners will be in leadership and they will be working towards policy. And the thing I would end on with AI is just don't be afraid of it as a technology. Don't be afraid to dive in and start getting a policy framework up. New South Wales, Queensland, SACE have already got policies online and they are phenomenally broad in scope. So take a look at them, but then make something custom and bespoke for your own context and just get onto it.
I like it. Well, on that note, we will get to the 6 in 60 seconds, one word or one idea. We'll see how we go. I tend to give people a grade out of 10, depending on whether they can stick to the rules or not, because generally no one sticks to the rules. You ready?
No, but go anyway.
All right. One educational narrative that's been underrated or overrated in the past decade.
The importance of teachers' perspectives in research.
Underrated or overrated?
Lastly, underrated.
Just clarifying.
Thanks for just clarifying.
Just to be clear.
Most interesting or surprising thing you've seen AI used for?
Turning a Furby into a talking end-of-the-world death monster.
I'm not sure I know what a Furby is.
You definitely weren't a child in the 90s. One of those horrible little furry talking bird toy things.
I reckon, Google it. I think that must be a UK thing. I'm putting it down to that. the most interesting PD you've ever done?
God, so many. The community of practice that I did with Fate into looking at close reading.
Who are you most interested in hearing from at EduTech 2023?
I missed Cheyenne Barr recently at a thing and we'd had a conversation. I think he's at EduTech, so I really want to see him because I've seen his TED talk and I found that very interesting.
We met him last year. He is a fascinating guy, so good answer there. One book worth reading?
What I Talk About When I Talk About Running by Haruki Murakami.
I'm impressed that you didn't say your own book, so that's good. Well played there.
And missed an opportunity there, didn't I?
Yeah, well, you know, gave you the opening. And one person we should interview on the podcast.
Lucinda, my supervisor. She's great.
Good answer. You'll get passed into the PhD, no problem now. Well, that brings an end to our show for today. I hope you've enjoyed our little chat with Leon. Matt. Closing comments. I know you've got them. Hit us.
Look, I love that, the opening around the AI iceberg. Just as an opportunity to come into the conversation, to look at opportunity, but also to be aware of I guess the data element, the technical element. So I think that's just a really important, you know, to an in, I guess, to the conversation. The second piece for me is that notion of, you know, don't be afraid, but be critical, be creative, and be bespoke in your response, be it policy, be the way that you're using it, the way that you see how you might bring it into your teaching and learning, how you might bring it into your schools. And I think the third piece is that word of caution around the hype. How might we as a community of professionals walk together in this journey rather than be competitive around it? So I just think that's a really, you know, interesting challenge to the profession more broadly. So they're kind of the three things that I'd pull out from the conversation today.
Excellent. Well, for me, I did agree on the iceberg. I really like that as an analogy for AI. And I think that complexity of you really don't know what's under the surface with AI. You don't know the size of it, you know, how big it's going to be, and the majority of it is underneath the surface. You know, like just the depth of where we are with the ethics of AI, you know, the privacy concerns, the copyright concerns, you know, what we need to be thinking about when it comes to AI more broadly rather than just, you know, how we're using it. And I think, you know, and we kind of talked on this, that bias, and I think that's something that society more broadly is coming to grips with and kind of grappling with, is the bias, the inherent bias in our views individually and how they've been shaped like that. The bias in things that we read and things that we've trusted over many years, whether it be newspapers or things like encyclopedias. But now it's, as you described, like that speed and that size of distribution of a product like ChatGPT means that we need to be ever more cautious of that bias that comes with using that type of product. So they're the insights from me. Leon, thanks again, you know, for giving up your time to share kind of your journey and your experiences and your knowledge on AI and where you've come from and where it's going. And I think for the audience out there, if you can get along to EduTech, you know, get along to Leon's, you know, talks at the event, I'm sure you'll take away a little bit more than you have today. For the audience out there, if they want to connect with you, Leon, where's the best place for them to find you on the internet?
You can find me at leonfurs.com. It's nice and easy. Or on LinkedIn, which is my main and pretty much only social media.
Excellent. Well, to the audience out there, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show and don't forget to share the love and tell a few of your colleagues, maybe the person responsible for your next PD day, that perhaps all of your staff should be listening to an episode of EdLeaders, and especially this episode if they are interested in learning a little bit more about AI. As I mentioned at the top of the show, if you're not already signed up to the newsletter, you're missing out. Publish every few weeks and it's jam-packed with nuggets to level up your school leadership game. Check out edleaders.com.au for more details. Thanks again to today's sponsor, EduTech. We couldn't do it without them, and we'd be grateful if you spend a few minutes checking it out, and hopefully you will see Matt, myself, Leon at the event in August later this year. You can connect with EdLeaders and both of us on LinkedIn, where we'll keep you up to date with all the latest of what we're up to. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Go well.
Thanks, everyone.